Welcome to the debate. So if a suspension bridge starts swaying, you know, dangerously in the wind, you don't just replace a single bolt.
No, obviously not.
Right. You have to look at the tension of the entire structure. The engineer understands that force is distributed across a dynamic, coupled network. Yet in modern biomedicine, we often treat the human body like, well, a bucket of isolated bolts.
And we are incredibly successful at replacing one broken part or, you know, patching a discrete lesion.
We are. But when a patient shows up with a chronic multi-system illness like dysautonomia or chronic fatigue or long COVID, that broken part approach just completely falls apart.
It really does. It completely strands both the patient and the clinician. I mean, I'll be the first to admit that chronic, environmentally contingent illness is the glaring blind spot of modern medicine.
Exactly. And that is exactly why we are diving into a really fascinating paper today. It's by Dr. Bishara Saheli, titled Coherence Physiology, the Embodied Substrate of Life-Coherent Medicine.
It's quite a title.
It is. But the core question we're debating today is whether shifting to this coherence physiology model, which means treating the body as a dynamically coupled living continuum, is the architectural breakthrough we desperately need to treat chronic illness.
And I know where you stand on this.
I argue that it absolutely is. I believe it gives us a rigorous, evidence-backed grammar to finally map the distributed causality of these conditions, and it provides a real pathway for genuine healing, which the paper calls salogenesis.
Right. And while I absolutely acknowledge the clinical value of an integrated view, I really do, my position is that this specific coherence model flirts with some serious epistemic overreach.
Overreach, how?
Well, it takes rock-solid biological science and wraps it up with highly exploratory, speculative frontier physics. By doing that, I think we risk sacrificing the very reductionist, falsifiable precision that makes modern medicine so remarkably effective in the first place.
Okay, well, let's lay the groundwork here. The prevailing biomedical model, what the paper terms the organ assemblage model, has kind of hit a wall.
For chronic illness, sure.
Right. We have patients suffering across specialty boundaries. Their circulation, their cognition, digestion, immune tone, they're all failing simultaneously. Yet their discrete lab tests often come back perfectly normal.
Which is incredibly frustrating for everyone involved.
Exactly. So Saheli's paper reorganizes physiology around seven interdependent layers of coherence, starting from the physical connective tissue all the way to the energetic governance of the mitochondria. I view this as an essential evolution. The body isn't an assemblage of parts. It's a living continuum.
And living continuum is a beautiful, intuitive concept. It really is. But we have to look critically at what we give up when we embrace that narrative too broadly.
But what are we giving up?
The historical power of biomedicine. It stems directly from its reductionism. I mean, our ability to isolate specific pathways, identify a discrete lesion, hit a targeted receptor with a pharmaceutical, that is what eradicated diseases and literally doubled human life expectancy.
But that reductionism is exactly what fails the chronic illness patient. When you only look for a single broken part and you don't find it, the institutional response is, well, often to just dismiss the patient.
And I agree that dismissing patients is a profound clinical failure. But my concern is that coherence physiology creates this theoretical everything is connected trap.
A trap?
Yeah, because when you take established science like nitric oxide signaling and you package it alongside speculative concepts under sweeping, almost poetic umbrella terms like boundary intelligence, the model becomes dangerously diffuse. It becomes too broad to test, too vague to target, and honestly, nearly impossible to falsify.
I don't think it's too vague to test at all. Provided we actually look at the physical reality of how the body is built. Let's look at the very first layer of this continuum, the physical substrate.
Okay.
Anatomically, the body is a continuum. For decades, medicine treated the extracellular matrix, the fascia, the interstitium, as mere wrapping paper.
Right, just the inert packing peanuts holding the important organs in place.
Exactly. But the evidence now strongly demonstrates that this material substrate is a sensory, mechanical, and fluidic network. Cells don't just exist in a void.
Which brings us to mechanotransduction. And for those who might not be tissue engineers listening today, mechanotransduction is the process where cells actually feel the physical tension
of their environment. They translate that mechanical force into chemical signals.
Yes, and the way I like to visualize it is like a spider web. So the extracellular matrix is the web, and the cells are the spiders. They don't just sit there passively.
Right.
If you pull a single silk thread on a spider web, the geometry of the entire web distorts. The spider physically feels that tension change. In our bodies, if a patient has a stiff, inflamed fascial matrix, the cells feel that stiffness.
They sense the tension.
Yes, it alters their making transduction, which in turn alters their gene expression and immune behavior.
It's a great analogy. If the web is vibrating, the spider assumes there's a threat.
Precisely. So treating a localized symptom with a targeted drug while completely ignoring that the entire web is pulled taut is missing the forest for the trees.
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that that's enough for clinical practice. Let me tell you why. I love the spider web analogy. It perfectly explains that things are connected, but clinical medicine requires discrete, actionable interventions.
Interventions can be holistic.
But if a patient is crashing in the clinic, I can't just prescribe a more relaxed spider web. I need to know the exact mechanism of failure. And this leads directly to my issue with the paper's evidence gradient.
What do you mean by evidence gradient?
Well, you bring up the fascial matrix and mechanotransduction, which is completely valid mainstream science. Absolutely. But the paper also explicitly includes something called interfacial water as a core component of this continuum.
It does, yeah. And interfacial water is fascinating. We're talking about the idea that water behaves differently when it's right up against a biological surface, like the inside of a blood vessel.
Right. And for the audience, this is the theory that water isn't just a liquid in the body. Near hydrophilic or water-loving surfaces, it actually changes phase.
It becomes almost like a gel.
Exactly. Excluding dissolved particles and actually holding an electrical charge, acting like a biological battery.
Which is incredible when you think about it.
It is mind-bending. But it's also explicitly marked in the text as an exploratory frontier. It is highly speculative physics. So my question is this whole living continuum framework a bit of a Trojan horse?
A Trojan horse?
Yeah. Are we allowing scientifically unproven theories to ride on the coattails of legitimate mechanobiology just because they share the same overarching holistic metaphor?
Calling it a Trojan horse is a bit uncharitable, I think. The paper is actually highly transparent about its epistemic discipline. Dr. Salehi explicitly cautions against treating interfacial water as some master explanation for all physiology.
But it's still foundational to the model.
Yes, because you can't just ignore the fact that the human body is utterly saturated with hydrated biological interfaces.
But we already have mechanistic explanations for how those interfaces work that don't require rewriting fluid dynamics.
Do we? Look at the endothelial glycocalyx. For those not versed in vascular biology, this is the microscopic, sugary, hair-like coating on the inside of every blood vessel in your body.
A crucial structure, yes.
It is universally accepted in mainstream science, and it relies entirely on its hydration layer to sense the sheer stress of blood flow and regulate things like nitric oxide.
Yes, the glycocalyx physically bends with the blood flow, triggering calcium channels. We know how that works.
But how does it maintain that exact fluidic dynamic? Acknowledging that the physics of water at that microscopic boundary might be a missing piece of the puzzle isn't abandoning rigor, it's a safeguard against the exact epistemic closure that leads modern medicine to stop asking questions when our current tools hit their limit.
I mean, I'm all for asking questions. Always. But integrating speculative biophysics into a clinical model just muddies the waters. However, let's step away from the physical structure for a moment.
Sure.
Because if we accept this web-like continuum, how does it actually break down? Because I think the paper's most significant clinical claim isn't about structure, but about pathology.
Ah, you're talking about defensive lock-in.
Exactly.
This is the absolute pivot of the whole framework. Conventionally, we look for a pathogen or a broken mechanism, but this framework suggests that in chronic multisystem illness, the pathology is actually a state of persistent, unresolved protection.
Meaning the organism gets stuck in defense mode.
Yes. The body experiences a severe perturbation, say a viral infection like COVID-19, or a massive toxic exposure, maybe severe physical trauma. The organism rightly mounts a defense.
As it should.
Right. So the mast cells, our immune system's first responders, become highly vigilant. They alter the permeability of the tissues. And crucially, the mitochondria engage what is known as the cell danger response.
Which is such a fascinating cellular mechanism. We usually think of mitochondria as just, you know, the powerhouses of the cell, churning out ATP for energy.
But they are also the cell's alarm bells. When they sense a threat, they literally downregulate ATP production. They stop making energy and start churning out inflammatory signaling molecules instead.
And we really should explain why they do that, because from an evolutionary perspective, it's brilliant.
Oh, it's genius.
Viruses don't have their own energy supply. They have to hijack the host cell's ATP to replicate. So when the cell senses a virus, the mitochondria shut down the power grid. They are literally trying to starve the virus by plunging the city into darkness.
It is a brilliant short-term defense. The illness occurs when the organism fails to stand down after the threat is gone. The city stays in darkness. That is defensive lock-in. It becomes a self-stabilizing loop.
Walk me through the loop then.
Okay. The mitochondria shut down the power. This sustains the immune alarm, keeping the mast cells hypervigilant. The mast cells release histamines, which stiffen that fascial matrix we talked about earlier.
Stiffening the spider web.
Right. The stiff matrix impairs fluid flow. The impaired flow degrades microvascular exchange, meaning tissues aren't getting enough oxygen. And what does that hypoxic environment do?
It signals a threat.
Exactly. It signals to the mitochondria that the body is still under threat.
So the defense mechanism is causing the exact conditions that trigger the defense mechanism.
Yes. And this completely explains the lived reality of these patients. Why do chronic fatigue patients experience post-exertional malaise? It's not because they are out of shape.
No, of course not.
Their mitochondria are actively refusing to allocate energy to movement because they are locked in a metabolic state of cellular defense.
I'll grant you, it is an incredibly elegant explanation. It maps perfectly onto the patient's subjective experience. But that's a compelling argument. But have you considered how clinically unmanageable this becomes?
Unmanageable?
Look at it from the perspective of a clinician on a Tuesday morning. How do you objectively measure a lock-in loop?
Well, you measure the downstream effects.
But pathway-focused care asks highly specific questions for a reason. What lipid marker is abnormal? What drug blocks that specific receptor? That reductionism is what saves lives in acute care.
In acute care, yes.
We measure LDL cholesterol, we prescribe a statin, we reduce cardiovascular mortality. If we accept this nebulous concept of a lock-in loop, don't we risk pathologizing a vague feedback cycle while missing acute, targetable underlying conditions?
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. That's a critical point, and the paper actually addresses it head-on. Coherence-informed assessment strictly requires conventional differential diagnosis first.
So you aren't ignoring the standard tests?
Not at all. You must rule out malignancies, you must rule out classic autoimmune diseases, structural lesions, and endocrine failures. Coherence physiology does not replace the search for a targetable lesion.
Okay.
It supplements it for the millions of people who pass all those conventional tests, are told their blood work is normal, but remain profoundly disabled.
Okay, but once you rule out the classic diseases and you decide the patient is in this defensive lock-in, where on earth does the physician actually intervene? If everything is causing everything else in a circular loop, what is the prescription?
You intervene at the layers of coherence you can access to change the environment the cells are experiencing. You improve the substrate by addressing fascial mobility. You use strict pacing protocols to stop triggering the mitochondrial danger response.
So it's environmental.
It shifts the question from what is the broken part? To what field conditions are preventing the specific organism from returning to a state of safety?
See, returning to a state of safety. This is exactly where I struggle. That is an emotional or psychological framework, not a physiological measurement.
It's biological safety.
But when the paper uses terms like boundary intelligence to describe capillaries and mast cells, it feels like we are anthropomorphizing cells. Mast cells do not have intelligence or feelings of safety. They have receptors that respond to ligands based on thermodynamics and biochemistry.
It's not anthropomorphizing them. It's recognizing that biological networks process information. I mean, a single ant isn't intelligent, but an ant colony exhibits immense spatial intelligence.
Sure,
The immune system processes environmental data and makes systemic decisions.
But when we use this sweeping language, it shifts the burden of care. It feels deeply validating to the patient, which I don't discount. Validation is important, but it doesn't give me a pharmacological target. It shifts the intervention away from measurable biology into the realm of lifestyle and environment. I completely disagree that it shifts away from biology. It just expands our definition of what constitutes biological data, which actually brings us perfectly to the ultimate point of contention here. How do we actually treat the patient?
Right. The difference between pathway suppression and what the paper calls salutogenesis.
Yes. Pathway suppression is our current standard of care. It's prescribing an immunosuppressant to block a specific inflammatory cytokine.
Which works.
It forces a downstream number on a lab chart to look normal, while the upstream tissue is still screaming that it's under threat. It is a coercive correction.
And salutogenesis?
Salutogenesis is the active biology of recovery. True healing requires field restoration. It means restoring the underlying conditions so the body can self-repair. My absolute favorite metaphor for this is the engine without oil.
Okay, let's hear it.
If a patient is completely exhausted because their mitochondria are in the cell danger response, and you give them a powerful pharmaceutical stimulant, you are suppressing the pathway of fatigue. They are awake.
But they aren't healed.
Right. You are forcing an engine to run at 8,000 RPMs when it has no oil. The pharmaceutical works, but the biological substrate is degrading faster. Field restoration says we have to sequence care.
Sequence it how?
You cannot demand a patient in defensive lock-in undergo rigorous physical conditioning. You have to achieve restorative sleep first to clear brain metabolites. You have to restore autonomic nervous system stability. You are restoring the physiological field so the body can drop its biological shields.
I hear that. And clinically, it sounds wonderful. It really does. But this is where the rubber meets the road, and where I think the coherence model severely overestimates the capacity of modern healthcare. Look at the variables you just listed.
Autonomic stability, sleep, microvascular perfusion.
Exactly. If a patient requires the perfectly synchronized restoration of sleep architecture, microvascular perfusion, mast cell calming, fascial release, and mitochondrial recoupling, the clinical variables become impossibly complex.
It's complex because the illness is complex.
But it practically demands an environment of total world restoration. We are asking a physician, who has perhaps 15 to 20 minutes with a patient, to fix their environmental exposures, their nervous system, their sleep hygiene, and their connective tissue. That is entirely outside the scope of a clinician's power.
But the framework isn't asking the clinician to fix the entire world in 20 minutes.
Isn't it?
No. It is asking the clinician to stop pretending that a pharmaceutical alone is a cure when the patient's biological environment is still toxic.
My fear is that this approach makes the perfect the enemy of the good. Under this holistic salutogenesis umbrella, we might abandon a highly helpful, targeted pharmaceutical, say a biologic that effectively suppresses a painful inflammatory cytokine, because it doesn't serve the organism's holistic movement toward coherence.
That's a mischaracterization.
We trade a blunt but effective tool for a sophisticated but impossible ideal.
But the paper explicitly states that targeted treatment and field restoration are not opposed. A patient may absolutely need pharmacology and environmental change, but field restoration acknowledges that sleep, for example, is not a lifestyle luxury.
No one is saying it is.
It is a profound, non-negotiable metabolic intervention. If you don't clear those metabolites, no biologic drug is going to fix the lock-in loop.
And no serious physician disagrees that sleep is biologically vital. But when you elevate every lifestyle factor to the level of a primary medical intervention under this umbrella of field restoration, you blur the lines of medical efficacy.
How so?
Because of the feedback loops. Under the reductionist model, if a patient takes a drug and doesn't get better, we have a clear feedback loop. Did we miss the lesion? Was the dose wrong? We adjust the tangible variables.
Right.
Under the coherence model, if the patient doesn't get better, the failure is endlessly distributed.
Meaning there are too many excuses for why a treatment failed?
Precisely. Oh, the environment wasn't right. The fascial matrix wasn't hydrated. The boundary intelligence was too alarmed. It becomes an unfalsifiable loop. If they heal, salutogenesis worked. If they don't, the field wasn't sufficiently restored. We lose the sharp, decisive feedback loop that allows medical science to rigorously discard failed therapies.
I see the danger there. I really do. But I don't think the model is unfalsifiable. I just think it requires us to track dynamic markers rather than static ones.
What kind of dynamic markers?
Well, instead of just looking at a static blood test taken at 9 a.m., a coherence-informed clinician tracks functional recovery. How long does it take the patient's heart rate to normalize after standing up?
Orthostatic tolerance.
Exactly. How many days does a symptom flare last after mild exertion? Those are highly measurable, falsifiable data points of systemic physiological function.
They are measurable symptoms, yes. But mapping those dynamic symptoms back to these seven specific layers of coherence requires a huge leap of faith that the mechanistic links are fully understood. And as we discussed with interfacial water and the physics of the glycocalyx, they simply are not.
But that is exactly why Dr. Saheli's paper is so vital right now. It is a call for a new physiology commons.
A commons?
Yes. It is begging the specialists, the mast cell biologists who understand histamine, the vascular researchers who understand the glycocalyx, the fascial tissue experts, to come out of their isolated silos. It's asking them to assemble their microcoherent research into a macro understanding of how the living continuum actually operates.
And I support interdisciplinary research wholeheartedly. The silos need to be broken down. But until that complex evidence is fully mature, we must be incredibly careful. We cannot replace the bedrock of targeted biomedicine with a beautiful, deeply empathetic, but potentially unnavigable map.
Well, as we bring this discussion to a close, my position remains that the coherence physiology framework isn't a rejection of modern biomedicine. It is its necessary maturation.
We'll have to agree to disagree on the readiness of it.
Fair enough. But by recognizing the body as a connected living continuum, from the mechanotransduction of our fascia to the viral starving defense of our mitochondria, we finally gain the conceptual tools to understand chronic illness. It gives us a way out of the trap of merely coercing the body by suppressing symptoms and points us toward actively supporting the conditions for adaptive self-repair.
And I maintain that while treating the whole organism is an undeniably admirable ideal, historical scientific progress relies on precise, falsifiable mechanisms. I caution that adopting sweeping, theoretically heavy frameworks, especially when they blend established cellular biology with exploratory biophysics, seriously risks blunting the sharp, reductionist tools that have defined our greatest medical triumphs.
This paper ultimately exposes the profound friction between the messy, distributed reality of living with a chronic illness and the highly siloed structure of how we currently organize medical knowledge. We highly encourage you to dive into the source material to explore Dr. Saheli's seven layers of coherence physiology for yourselves.
It is undeniably a paradigm shift worth watching closely, and one that forces us to ask very hard questions about the limits of our current tools.
So when you look back at that suspension bridge swaying in the wind, you have to ask yourself, are you going to keep replacing the single bolt that keeps snapping? Or are you finally going to step back, look at the entire continuum, and figure out why the wind is tearing the structure apart in the first place?